Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 122. Joining me on the show are Laura Fissel from Real World Theology and Elijah Davidson from Real Spirituality. So listen up, because this is a really, really good show. On this episode, we talk La La Land and being an artist. Well, let me try again. What I'm curious about, Elijah, is... do you feel that La La Land, while it's getting critical praise, is something that like general audiences can really get into? Or is it just something like the, you know, a couple years back we had The Artist, where it's like, I can't believe people are making films like this again. Let's give it an Academy Award. Like, is La La Land going to stand up to general audiences for a while? Inquiring minds want to know.
Well, I don't think, like you mentioned The Artist there, I don't think general audiences really probably saw The Artist that much, or probably were saying that about The Artist. I think the people who gave The Artist like the Best Picture Award were like, oh yeah, movies are great, this celebrates movies, and it looks like we care about art, so let's give it the award, you know?
I hope that was the exact conversation.
Did you like The Artist, Elijah?
I didn't like The Artist.
I couldn't tell.
Yeah, because you mentioned like the award thing, and like I think the Oscars have a kind of a bad track record of giving Best Picture to the movie that pats them on the back, pats the Academy voters in the back. Which is cool, because it's like their award. So if they want to award something that they're awesome, they can, you know?
I am definitely having Elijah on for the Oscar pre-show episode.
You want the president to come on the stage and give herself an Oscar that says, I'm awesome.
That's basically what the Oscars are, though, you know? So I do think that La La Land will probably win Best Picture.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah, because it loves how awesome movies are. I don't want to be super negative on La La Land too quickly in the conversation. But I think that La La Land is rather patronizing to its audience. And two levels. Like, on the one hand, I think that it knows that the movie Academy movie people will be like, yeah, it loves us, so let's give it an award. And on the other hand, I don't think it believes that the general movie-going audience has seen many musicals. And so I think it thinks it's awesome by introducing musicals to the general public. I think it thinks it's awesome for doing that. And I don't think that is that big of a deal. I think people have seen White Christmas and Singing in the Rain and so forth. So I don't think that's that big of a thing.
Well, thanks to this Christmas and Laura's prodding, yes, I have seen those films finally.
You're welcome. And also the one that Mikey calls the racist one.
The racist one. We didn't watch
there's a lot of those. Which one is it?
Yeah, we didn't watch the racist one this year, though.
Holiday Inn, because they do blackface.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit more racist than White Christmas, that's true.
Yeah. It's hard to watch something that's so like unintentionally racist. It's just like, you know, steeped in like cultural tradition of racism.
Yeah.
You know, it's like no one said, hey guys, you guys want to do some racist things? You know, they're just like, hey, these are totally normal things we did in 1950 or something like that.
And now we're all smacking our foreheads.
And now we're like, oh man.
Well, that's one of the problems. Like, so musicals are, though, like, have long been like inadvertently racist, and in less like more subtle ways than that. You know, blackface and Holiday Inn, you know, because a lot of times they're stealing musical forms from other cultures and reappropriating them for white people to do it. And And that's kind of a subtle racist move, colonial kind of move. And I, like I said, I don't want to be too hard on La La Land. I should say up front that I actually found La La Land to be a lot of fun. But I think it is guilty of that. The cool white guy is going to save jazz. I mean,
thank you, Ryan Gosling.
It really bothers me. Especially when it's like talking in a bad way to John Legend, you know?
Well, it was hard for me. As long as John Legend doesn't know what's up with real jazz, he's going to get right. talked to that way.
Right.
Ryan Gosling's not going to take his crap. Well, I like how you caveat it. So all the people who tuned in that love La La Land are and that were getting ready, to turn off their podcast. They're like, I guess I'll just listen to a different episode. They're like, who's this Elijah Davidson? How can I kill him?
Well, you did tell them in the beginning where he lived.
You did.
Yeah. Well, that's only if that part probably will not make the. I will make sure that doesn't make the podcast.
Gotcha.
That way, no one knows that you live in Pasadena, California.
You're safe, Elijah. Oh,
no,
it's that all is over on every now. Social media profile. So
well, okay, so I asked that, and I'm really glad that you caveat it that way, because I'm curious, do you have, I know it kind of seems weird that I'm not asking Laura these same questions, but obviously I know the answer in Laura's case. I will ask her, but I want to start with you and say, so do you have, like, surely you've got, like, Even though you're kind of steeped in with your job, lots of people who care a lot about film.
Yeah.
Like, you also have, like, your group of friends or relatives or acquaintances that aren't really into film, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So, are both these groups of people in your world going to see this movie? Like, I mean, currently going to see it, not like, are they going to in the future see it? But, like, are your non-movie friends like, oh yeah, have you seen La La Land? It's pretty great.
No, of course not.
They're like, they're
going to see Star Wars four times.
Yeah, right. You know? Like, how many times have you seen Rogue One? Right.
Yeah,
Not that I really have a problem with that, but I'm just, sure. I think that's the experience that I'm having right now.
Yeah. That's totally true.
Yeah, which is why I'm asking you the question in the first place. And I never got around to seeing The Artist. I think Laura ended up watching it when I wasn't here one day, and then I just couldn't get up the desire to see it. Yeah.
So you did not miss anything. I do not like that movie.
I was quite underwhelmed.
Yeah.
And with a response like that, I couldn't really, you know, Laura didn't go, my mind was blown in a great, awesome, mind-exploding, spiritual way. She was just kind of like, oh, yeah. And I'm like, oh.
Mm-hmm.
For a best
That's a good response.
Laura nailed it. So, that's the whole reason I asked this question, to kind of intro this at all, because I am just curious where some of this praise is coming from. Like, and I'm wondering, is it going to be something that sticks around for a while? Because honestly, personally, I did have a lot of fun watching La La Land. And I was amazed at times, because I've now realized that I will go see probably anything Damien Chazelle does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Until he gives me many reasons not to.
Mm-hmm.
But I know I left frustrated for a couple reasons that we'll get into much later in the show. But I was not a big fan of musicals in general. Mm. And this kind of made me have fun watching a musical.
Huh.
So what I am now curious to ask Laura is, I know that you are a fan of musicals.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to figure out, where does that love, like, what does a musical do for you that you are even enticed to go see them? Or to watch these ones that you've seen lots of times from childhood?
Well, I think as a child, they were really accessible, because they're very, like, I kind of want to use the word naive, but maybe simplistic is a little bit kinder, because everyone's saying exactly how they feel. You don't have to wonder. So I think that made them accessible and, you know, interesting and fun, because the dancing is not something that you would, it's not something that I saw really in any other medium than there. Hmm. You know, I didn't go to like tap shows or something, you know, I don't know.
Why not?
Maybe there's a whole contingency of people who go to like dance contests. I don't know.
They all live in Pasadena.
But, I don't know. It's something that you wouldn't see anywhere else, really. Like a combination of different art forms altogether. And also I think because they tend to be rather joyful, although I haven't seen the Umbrellas of... which I've heard is not very joyful.
Of Cherbourg?
Yeah.
Of Sheboygan? The...
It is, though. It is joyful.
It yeah. is? Okay.
The first like half of it is like the like a concentrated dose of the joy of young love. Mm. Like very, yeah, very thrilling and good. Yeah. But then so, pretty melancholy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would say that overall my like my memories associated with musicals and the reason why I like to revisit them is because of that just fun, joyful kind of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Like the stories, I honestly don't really remember the stories of those musicals until I'm watching them. I'm like, oh yeah, that's what this is about. I remember the songs and the numbers, mm-hmm. you know, and honestly, that's probably what I'll remember from La La Land most. I really liked the music a lot. I think I would enjoy listening to the soundtrack again and again.
Yeah, I would say that I'd probably agree with that. I feel like I've watched a lot of Disney movies over the past couple years that, you know, like look at the Frozen and even the Moana and stuff. And people were like, oh, the song was so great. And I was like, it was a song.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe I'm not seeing it enough. Maybe our son isn't old enough to like walk around the house, like playing it on repeat so that I can't get it out of my head or something like that, you know, yeah. things to look forward to. But I typically am just not been really captured by some of these songs, but I was pretty enthralled with most of the stuff I heard in La La Land. And when you talk about like the numbers and the music and stuff, I think we could actually talk about La La Land for like just an hour and a half on technical merit alone,
mm-hmm.
because there's a lot going on here. I mean, it was, it's one of the first times in a long time that I'm watching a movie and I thought while watching the film, and maybe this is my own fault from the movies I've been watching recently, that I was like, I would have never thought to do it that way.
Hmm.
I was like, what an incredible way to like film this piece or to light this scene,
mm-hmm.
or to, you know, to bring about this focus on a certain thing. Like which goes back to me saying that I'll probably go watch anything that Damien Chazelle does until he puts out a couple stinkers, because Whiplash is my favorite movie the year it came out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I said, for any issues that I have with La La Land, directing was not among them.
I do feel like, I don't think I would have been able to articulate it this way until I read an article about it, but it does feel very seamless to me, all the pieces that they fit together really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I read an article about how the film was made, and maybe I'll find it again and send it to you for the show notes, because it's really interesting. I think it's entitled something like How Damien Chazelle Achieved the Magic of La La Land. But basically it was talking about like how the pieces came together, and it was really cool to discover that it wasn't like there was a story for La La Land and then they wrote music for it, or they choreographed for it, or they, you know, or they had the music and they did the lighting for the music. Actually, all the pieces were kind of being created together, and then when another piece was added, they kind of compromised and melded to each other, which is really cool to know. And I think I felt that in the film, that, you know, sometimes the lyrics were changed because of the way the actors were coming to them, or you know, where a scene was blocked differently for the lighting, or, you know, so, and maybe that's always how films are made. But this one specifically felt pretty seamless to me. And it was cool to know that lots of different artists with different talents and skills were genuinely working together.
Kind of like actively.
Yeah. Listening to each other and being willing to compromise and change. And so anyway, I thought that was really cool and evident in the film.
Mm. So, Elijah, something I'm curious, you know, I know we've talked about, like, there's probably a certain type of moviegoer that's catching this film or really catching on with this film, but in your opinion, or maybe in your fact, What does La La Land do differently that brings like the musical to a new age? Or, you know, what is it about it that people are loving so much? What is he doing differently?
What's it doing differently? Like, what's it doing differently than the other musicals that have come out this year that I kind of like more?
Oh, actually, yes. That wasn't my question, but now it is now definitely my question.
Well, I think it's a good way to answer your question, though, because like, there have been other musicals and other dance movies this year that, like The Fitz, for instance, that's it's a dance movie for sure. You'd have to call it a musical, I think, or Sing Street is a musical. Maybe you'd call it a dance movie too. It's a dance movie in the way that a lot of La La Land is a dance movie, which is not necessarily dancing. It's kind of choreographed, moving around and stuff, which is a kind of dance, I suppose. but those have not been as embraced as La La Land. La La Land is definitely romantic. Like, it gives you that story thing, that real easy story thing to attach onto. And it gives you like the right songs to hit those romantic beats that you kind of expect, you know, like the story, guy meets girl, guy and girl don't really get along, decide they do like each other, fall in love kind of thing. You know, that's pretty basic. Mm-hmm. But that works to La La Land's advantage, you know, because they can hit those expected notes and do it really well. And I think y'all are right that they hit them really well, in a really kind of fun, energetic kind of way, which is, and, you know, something like The Fitz is pretty, it's like 2001, A Space Odyssey. Like, it kind of puts you on your heels the entire time because it's so weird. Or Sing Street is kind of that John Carney, like, simplified, stripped down kind of thing. And they speak in an Irish accent, so you can't really understand them half the time. So it's a little bit harder to get a handle on. But La La Land is, like, exactly what you want from a musical, I think.
Well, so then that does lead to maybe a better version of the question that I wanted to ask, which is, people keep comparing La La Land to, like, ushering in, like, these old school musicals, like, oh, it's just reminiscent of this, you know, or that. So, but what is it doing different, in your opinion?
Than
the old school musicals.
I don't think it's doing any different than the old school musical.
Yeah, I think that's why it's probably more popular than, like, Sing Street, which we really enjoyed, because it is more traditionally. I mean, there were dance scenes, there were pretty much every dance and song scene reminded me of another musical I'd seen. Mm-hmm. So, and, or recalled to me, like, you know, Gene Kelly or Fred Astaire. Yeah, yeah. So I don't think it's doing anything differently. I think it's I don't know. What do you say? Like a love letter to that, form?
An homage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. An homage to it.
Yeah. I mean, you think about something like, I like the Get Down. Baz Luhrmann series on Netflix came out this year. Did y'all watch that at all?
Not yet.
No, not yet.
Okay. That's a musical, you know? I mean, Baz Luhrmann doesn't make anything. It's not a musical on some level. Yeah. But, you know, his style is very abrasive and abrupt and in your face and everything. And that's not always easy for people to enjoy, you know? Like, that is new. That's different. So, like, you watch something like Moulin Rouge, like, that's a step forward in the musical form in cinema. Once actually, like, is because of its budget and the kind of the elliptical nature of the film itself, like, is actually a step forward in the idea of the musical form. La La Land's not, and I don't mean that as a big criticism of it. It's doing what it's doing, you know.
So are you talking mostly that it's not branching technically, or that there's nothing different about what we're seeing in La La Land, really?
Both.
So we watched La La Land, and when Laura and I left the theater, I remember I was mad. Yeah. Like we
it was like one of the best dates we've had in a long
time. It was an amazing date. Hashtag real life, you know. It's an amazing date because basically the whole ride home, like, we're just having like this very intense discussion, and I'm actually very mad. Because there's this movie that I was really, really enjoying, and then it drops like this thematic question, which I probably should have, if I thought about it for half a second, should have seen coming because of what I saw in Whiplash. And I feel like now there's this thematic piece to Damien Chazelle's movies where he's not really as interested in maybe a conclusion as he is asking you a question.
Mm-hmm. Or presenting, almost presenting options or presenting. Yeah. Cause it's not like, it's not just one question, is it?
Well, I mean, I guess that's kind of like, I want an opinion on it. Like is he asking a question? Is it just a, like, cause to me, I felt like he was, I mean, you could say he's presenting a life complication, but I think it's a little different than that. I think he actually is bringing you right up to the point and saying, well, which one would you do? Or what would you do? Maybe not either or, but just like a open-ended, what would you do? I feel like that's the end of Whiplash.
Yeah.
You know, the end, and we have a really great episode on Whiplash. You're all welcome to listen to it. But you know, you come right up to the edge and you say, okay, well, what would you have done differently? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, what would have broken you? What would have stopped you? Would you have pushed through? And I feel like, so thematically, he's doing something here in La La Land too, that obviously, pushed some buttons and made our brains explode a little bit. But in a positive way. So I do think a second, huge mark for this film outside of like a, you know, technically it is reminiscent of old school, musical. It does, allow us to have a lot of fun. It does draw us in with maybe a typical like guy meets girl kind of story, but it also makes us think, or at least it made me think. And not only think, but I think about a wide variety of things. So thematically, it's definitely not a snoozer. And actually, in Joel Mayward's review over at CineMayward, he states that La La Land celebrates the vocational pursuits of dreamers, artists, and romantics. And I was like, oh, that's fair. But then I kind of said, well, while I agree with that, I guess the question is, like, at what cost? So I'm kind of curious. Elijah, did you see it as thematically trying to push people to fill the world with more artists, or did you see the conflict in the relationship as more of a thematic push? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, I understand your options.
Or you can pick something or C, none of the above, whatever Elijah wants to say.
I think the movie, I think La La Land wants you to cheer the, I would say, kind of selfish, do whatever it takes at all costs artists in your life. That though they may be jerks, and a bit antisocial, they're doing something worthwhile, maybe. That might be as generous as I get with it.
So I asked you, I think before the show, if your wife had seen it, because I'm curious, because another thing that Joel kind of asks is, are these definitely non-rhetorical questions that, he said he saw it with his wife. I saw it with my wife. And some of the questions that we're asking as a couple are the dreams we've had, are there dreams we've had to compromise on, because of our relationship? Is it possible to have both one's dreams and a healthy, committed relationship? And is it better to have loved and lost, or is love a lifelong act of fidelity? Like I said, and giving full credit to Joel for kind of articulating these questions, but also realizing that that's the question. Those are the questions that Laura and I were kind of wrestling with. You know, like, do we have to choose? Did we choose? Did we sacrifice something? And I'm curious of how you feel about that general concept. Like, do you feel like there are things in your life, because I want your wife to listen to this episode, that you had to compromise because you were married, or like, is that, are those separate things?
Yeah. That's a good question. I kind of had a long conversation with my work wife, with Eugene Stewart, who has seen the movie a couple of times now. He's also a real spirituality co-director about La La Land today. We talked about that for a while. You know, it's a, I've been asking this question of myself for a long time. The movie for me that always really puts that to me is Spider-Man 2, because that's a movie that where there's someone who is in love, but he also has a strong sense of calling, and those two things seem to be mutually exclusive. He can be Spider-Man, but he can't have Mary Jane, or he can have Mary Jane and he can't be Spider-Man, and the kind of plot kind of bears that out for a while. And I used to love and hate that movie because I hated asking myself that question, because I kind of felt that same thing in my own life when I, before I was married. I just kind of thought, okay, I'm either going to be what I think God wants me to be, or what God's called me to, or I'm going to be married. And there's not much room for either, for both those things in my life. And you know, and I would read verses like when Jesus said, like, if you don't like hate your mother, your brother, your sister, your father, whatever, you can't be with me. And I would be like, come on, Jesus. like, that's too hard, you know? And I hated that a lot. And I think it's definitely true that La La Land lends itself to those same kind of questions. Do you want to know how I answer that question?
Sure. I feel like I don't really want you to answer that question until a little bit later, but I, like, you're here and I want to know right now. So,
well, that's a long story, I suppose.
Oh, we've still got like an hour, so.
Yeah, like 10 years of life there, you know, that, to work that question out. I mean, long story short, I am married now, and I don't feel like being married has forced me to necessarily compromise any sense of calling that I have. In some ways, it's complicated, my calling, because I have my wife's calling alongside my own, and we have a joint calling together, and it's a richer thing, I suppose. I do agree that that if I wasn't married, or if I eschewed love, romantic love, that I would probably have the potential to be a better writer over the course of my life, because I would have nothing else pulling on my attention.
But no experiences to write about.
I would still have experience to write. No, that's not true. That's not true. I reached a point. I know you're making a joke, but I reached a point when I was how old was I? I was 27 years old, 26 years old, something
just,
like that.
Just like a year or two ago.
Just a few years, a couple of years, last year. but I got to the place where I was like pretty content, like being single. Like I was like, you know what? I'm always, if I never get married, like I'm probably always going to be a little bit lonely. Like there's part of me that's always going to wonder what that would be like, but I'm not going to be unhappy. And I kind of figured out that, like, there's a lot of things that I would be able to do in life that I won't be able to do married at that time. And because you just don't have the same kind of freedom married that you do when you're single. I mean, I just got a text message from my wife, asked me where I was, like, literally a minute ago, you know? like, so I'm going to have to, like, at some point, I have to stop podcasting and go home. I guess. Because there's this person who loves me and wants to know where I am. And if I was single, that would not happen. I could talk your ear off for hours. And so, you know, all the better for you that I'm married. but it's true, you know, like there's some things I won't be able to do, but there's a married from single. But I did. I figured out that being single, I would still have relationships. I would still have friends, people who love me, people who I loved. I would be okay. I would have been okay. I would have learned to be okay. It would have been fine. I mean, in Christian history, there's this long tradition of people who, you know, eschew marriage and choose God instead. I mean, monks and nuns and all the original church.
That's what Paul encourages us to do in the first place, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, that was a radical thing, because what that was belief in the resurrection is what that was, because you were saying, I don't have to have kids to live forever. Hmm. I'm going to be resurrected. So I don't have to get married and have the kid thing for that. That was a huge statement of faith in Christ to not get married. And it still is that, you know, for the people to do that now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and those people live full lives. I mean, I'm going to say they don't live full lives. And so I realized that was possible, and I got pretty content with that. And I was like, you know, if God wants me to be married one of these days, great. You know, like I did kind of believe that was something God wanted for me. And so I pursued that. But if it never worked out, it's fine. I was going to be okay, you know? So I learned that. And I think since being married, I've learned that there are some things about, like I said, being married that mean I'm not going to be the same writer that I would be otherwise. But there are other things about being married that make it possible for me to be a better writer in some ways. Like my wife helps me with life, and she's a very disciplined person. And so I get to draw on some of that, skill, that discipline skill. And I get up and I go write in the morning, you know, before I go to work. And, I finish things because of that I wouldn't have finished otherwise. That's a good thing, you know? So you gain some things, you don't gain others. It's not. I just don't believe that the question is as black and white as La La Land would have you believe.
I think that's exactly what I wrote in my notes.
Thanks for sharing that, Elijah. I honestly did not think about this parallel in my own life until you started talking about it that way. I would say that Mikey and I came to that same state of being when we were pursuing being parents, and that whole journey was a lot longer than we thought it would be. And when we got some really bad news about our ability to have children or not in this case, we kind of spent a year, I would say about a year, just kind of living into the lives that we had at that time and the relationships we had. And we had a room that we had set aside for a nursery, and we just turned it into a creative space for us. And I think we came to the conclusion that if it was just us for the rest of our lives, we would be really happy. We could enjoy life. But I do think that we felt kind of this pull on our hearts that we knew that we wanted to experience parenthood together. So we sought out another way to make that happen. And so I think, and I'm a writer also, and I think the thing that that I didn't see before is that I'm struggling with this idea that to be a mom, I can only be a mom or be an artist. I can't do both because I haven't had time to do any writing. I have no time to do any writing. I barely have time to, you know, take a shower. So, and I think the problem maybe is that I'm evaluating what artist means by kind of an unfair, definition. Mm-hmm. I think that the world would say, society maybe would say that if I don't ever publish anything, if no one ever reads what I write, then I'm not a writer, not an artist. And I would like to be published. I really would like to find a rhythm of life that allowed me to write regularly and work on a project to completion. But I'm not really sure they're mutually exclusive. I think maybe being an artist just looks different. And I think that the conflict maybe is in our definition of what those things look like. Because, well, are we, I don't know what section of the conversation we're in, but I think that it seems like the film is saying that Mia and Seb could not be artists and also, they couldn't like reach their potential as artists and also be in a loving relationship, or at least one of them couldn't. And I think maybe, and honestly, your article also helped me think about this in a new way too. I think maybe it just would, maybe it would look different, you know, maybe they would, she would act on a smaller stage, or he wouldn't have a club, but he would play in jazz clubs elsewhere. So maybe the problem is more the idol of the one specific dream and the inability to be creative with what that looks like.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. Yeah, I really do. And it's the, being an artist, like, I think we put a lot of, we society, our culture, like we put a lot of value in the esteem of others, or the success, however you like, the public success side of it, kind of thing, like the finishing the thing, the getting it on the screen, the
the money.
Yeah, the money. Sure, that's like what better indicator of value do we have in that side? The money. We don't do a lot to value the process that any of that stuff gets made and done. And that's what art making is. That's what being an artist is, you know, is being about the process, doing the actual writing when you have time to do it, like however you, what, either little or much amount of time you have, you know, that just to be faithful to, from writing perspective, just to do that thing.
It always struck me as very odd that whenever I told somebody that I was a writer, i.e. my craft is words, that the first thing they always asked about had to do with numbers.
Yeah. It's pretty goofy. It's hard to break free of that too, you know, and like put the value in the act of writing rather than in the having written.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. Just, I took my son on a walk the other day, and a poem came to me, and I'm not really a poet, but just some beautiful lines about images that I was seeing as I walked, and I just kind of voice recorded them into my phone, and I thought, well, I'll come home and I'll write them down and try to craft something. But then I just felt like they had achieved the purpose they were meant to achieve. I didn't feel like writing them down was going to give them a life that they had not, that they didn't already have, or a purpose they didn't already have. It was like a beautiful moment that I shared, I would say, with my creator, you know, and I, and that was okay. But I don't think I'm really ever going to find many people who say like, oh yeah, yeah, that means you're an artist.
But it does mean you're an artist.
I think we're dancing a big one cut dance number
tapping around
this idea, and you know, I think there is merit in looking at a film for the questions that like it asks, like the larger culture, but I do think the question that it asked kind of bothered me, because much like you said, Elijah, and much like I had in my notes, I just didn't see the question as black and white as it seemed to be presented. Like, especially because of how I see the world and how I personally value success or fame, kind of like we're already talking about, you know, we obviously see that differently. We define artistry differently than the average person on the street that we tell what we do. So I'm kind of curious, Elijah. Well, I'm not really curious. I'm actually fascinated. You talked about, because I think your review stood out among a whole bunch of people who really, really like La La Land by basically saying, it's great, it's probably going to win an award, I had a lot of fun, but there's this idea that, well, there's like two or three ideas that stuck with you. And one of those was, you talked about how there is this picture of choice being love or fame. And how... And I'm really paraphrasing here because I want you to kind of explain this, or usher this in. It is, to the Christian, those are really both false promises.
Yeah, it was true to self or true to the opinion of others. And both those things were about being famous.
Yeah.
Success in your own eyes or success in the eyes of people around you. Yeah.
And I was just, I was looking at the lyrics of all the biggest songs from the film. And I noticed that Another Day of Sun is basically about that, completely about that one idea that the most worthy pursuit is the fame, is the art. In fact, the first girl says that she left this guy to come to LA to pursue the screen. And there's a line that says something like, you know, maybe could be brave or just insane, because maybe in that sleepy town, he'll sit one day, he'll see my face and think of how he used to know me. Like, I'm like, okay, that seems pretty selfish. And then City of Lights, wait, is that it? City of Stars? City of Lights?
City of Stars.
City of Stars is completely about the other thing, about this is what people want. You know, what everyone in LA wants is someone to love, someone who's there, who says it's going to be okay. This magical connection, that's what they want. So two of the key songs are actually fleshing out those desires.
Yeah. And it's, that's good. It's good to know.
So I would say that people who kind of, and I don't want to make it sound bad, because I think there is a lot, like another thing we danced around was like the idea that like our, what we would call calling our purpose, our dreams, depending on what level of spirituality you were at in those terms, that's important. Whatever we are supposed to do, much like it's very difficult, to read in the Bible, like, you know, Elijah, you're saying you're reading verses that said, like, unless you, you know, hate your mother and father and your brother and stuff, like, there's this one thing that you're supposed to be pursuing. So if we're called to do something, we shouldn't let anything stand in that way. But a lot of, I think, like, a lot of the people who are defending, like, this pursuit of the dream are defending it based on actions in the film. Or at least they're the way they're depicted. And I think that's what I saw you pick apart pretty well, Elijah. And I'm interested in you, like I said, just talking a little bit about the difference between pursuing your dream and what we kind of see in La La Land specifically. Or pursuing a calling versus what we kind of see in La La Land.
Yeah. Are you talking about how I don't talk, how I write about how they don't ever show them practicing?
Yeah.
Is that what you're referring
to?
Yeah. They don't ever show them practicing.
thank you.
They don't. I mean, they don't. They have great talent. Like, it's kind of clear that these two people, with Mia and Sebastian, right? That they have a lot of talent. And because they have this talent, they're owed the stage, you know? They're owed success in some way. They just apply that talent and people finally notice how great they are, you know. They never show them practicing, they never show them developing their craft at all. Like there's like one scene of Sebastian playing the piano in their apartment, you know, that's the City of Stars or whatever, he's kind of tapping up, they sing together. But it's not like he's really like practicing it. He kind of already has that song figured out, right?
Well, except for there is one practice scene.
One practice scene. And then there's go ahead.
Well, I mean, because he's like trying to figure out that one melody in the car.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
And he listens to the record. And then also at that time, Mia is practicing an audition.
Yeah, yeah. It does show her doing the auditions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it shows her this little montage-y thing of her practicing for her show. That one, you know. But those are so, like, that's just so brief, you know.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be any value on the craft of it, just the day-to-day practice of it. Like if they have a calling, like, and they're being true to some calling that they have not expressed to me as I watch the movie, I suppose someone could have a call to be famous, maybe. That could, I can conceive of a world where that's someone's calling.
Anything is possible, I guess.
Anything is possible. Yeah. Seems unlikely, but you know, I guess it could happen. That seems to be the only thing they're pursuing. Is is success in their own eyes or in the eyes of the world. And that's a pretty small vision, I think, of what it should be. I mean, and we don't, I would say, as a Christian, like my calling, my one calling is to love the Lord my God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength. And this next runner up for that is love my neighbor, you know? And how that exactly looks in my life, like, I think that's something that God kind of directs. But whatever that other things are, they yield to those things. Like, that's all we're called to do, you know? Love God and love our neighbors.
So it's hard to translate the message of La La Land, which is obviously not basing their dreams in a spiritual framework.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's not part of their, it's not even, that's not even a question. You know, it doesn't even exist in that world. Yeah.
I want to push back a little bit.
Yeah, do it.
And I'm going to be kind of processing this a little bit as I go along, so I apologize. But I think this is actually the root of Mikey and my disagreement after we watched it. Because there's an element that I find in the film worthy of giving a little credence to, which is that they both have a really intense passion for what they do. It's not, I think I would disagree that it's all about fame for them. I think maybe they're blindsided by the way that the world defines, what it looks like to be a successful, whatever they want to be. But I do find in them a true passion for what they are pursuing. And I would say it's probably most obvious in Seb because of how he talks about his love for jazz and how he's not seeing it in current culture and how he wants to kind of revive that. And I think especially it's seen for Mia she talks about her aunt a little bit and how that's the inspiration for her as an actress. But I think really in her song, the audition song, The Fools Who Dream, I think it is. Mm-hmm. I think that helped me to understand that this connection to her aunt was really powerful, especially because this song seems to show that her aunt died early because of addiction. Mm-hmm. But that she really latched on to this this kind of wild, passionate pursuit that her aunt had for something that she loved. So I just feel like that has a place somewhere. I don't really like the conclusion the film comes to. I don't agree with it because probably first and foremost, because I would not have made that choice. But I do think there's something to be said of them pursuing something that is just burning in their souls. It kind of reminds me of something from this book that I love called The Artist's Way by Julie Cameron, where she says something like, it's easier to write than not write, or it's easier to, act than not act. That you can't, when you have like a passion or a gift, it's easier to do it than not do it because it's something that's burning in you that has to get out. So I don't know if that is connecting to either of you at all, if you want to speak to that, or did you not see that at all? I mean, I do think there's a big element of selfishness present. I mean, I think even the beautiful line, here's to the hearts that ache, here's to the mess we make. That's kind of, in a way, I feel like that's kind of saying like, yeah, we're going to make a mess and y'all just deal with it. but I also identify with that song. I mean, I think this song was probably one of my favorite parts of the movie, where she says, that's why they need us. So bring on the rebels, the ripples from pebbles, the painters, the poets, and plays. And I do think, I have a passion in me to write, and I want to believe that there's a purpose for it, that it's going to bring meaning to the world or to people around me in a unique way, you know? So I think those things are worth pursuing. Anyway,
No.
Any of that resonate at all?
So I love the idea that someone. Well, let me say it this way. I genuinely believe in almost every case, just short of it being like an absolute, that if we are super passionate about something, that God has put that passion there for a reason. And that we should pursue it. Mm-hmm. And depending on the level or skill or opportunity of that passion, like I said, we shouldn't get sidetracked. Now it's hard to, like, again, to make a one for one to this movie, to how we would see this, because, you know, they're not saying God called me to open a jazz club.
Right.
You know, so it's hard to make a one for one, but I would still say, you know, even people who aren't religious, their passions, I still think, are put there because they're created in the image of God and God has mm-hmm. his hand in creating them. So I would say, yes, pursue these things. The thing that takes kind of a side or like a left turn for me is something that we've already talked about. And the interesting thing is what we talked about was marriage.
Right.
And how we personally have made decisions based on the fact that we're married. And I asked a question to our Facebook discussion group, kind of saying, you know, very, very broad, because I'm just kind of curious where people's minds were going to go. Like, do you think that, you know, the decisions made by Seb and Mia in the film were the right decision or not? And then, you know, part two is, do you think that decision, or do you think if they were married, that it would have changed that decision?
Mm-hmm. And it totally would for me, because then you enter, you know, breaking a covenant, but.
Exactly. So what's tough for me is, since this isn't one for one, and I don't really want to sound judgy about it, but since Seb and Mia are not Christians, or at least the film does not portray them in any way that has a pull on their life or influence in their decision making, what's the real difference between what they have and what a marriage would bring them? Because what I'm seeing is in their relationship that we're basically told can't work is what a lot of us see in marriage, which is, I don't think either of them would have been successful had they not actually found each other, because mm-hmm. When you have that person in marriage, it actually helps you push you to your calling. Like, it's not separate. It's not like I'm married, so I've given up my calling, and maybe I'll just do a little bit of my calling and also be married, mm-hmm. which is kind of maybe in my calling too. It's like, no, you're still living fully into your calling, but you have someone who's pushing you to that person God is wanting you to, or, you know, has pictured you to be.
Which they definitely did for each other.
Which is what they do for each other. Like, I don't think in this movie, the way it was presented, that Mia ever does her one-person show without Seb being there in relationship with her, pushing her to be to into her calling. I think her calling dies in that coffee shop. If without Seb, and the mm-hmm. same thing is true. The thing that we see Seb giving up is him stop pursuing his calling, but Mia calling him back into what his dream is. Mm-hmm. Now, in the timeline that we get, obviously there's some friction there, but the idea that the only way they can ever achieve these goals is letting one go off to France and letting one go on tour. Basically, for me to accept that makes me have to forget the previous hour of movie that I've seen.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause the assumption is that since they got where they are because of each other, how are they going to continue to grow and develop?
Yeah, I think without each other, mm-hmm. they've proved on their own they don't have what it takes to push the person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that people can learn, right? I mean, they could have learned that from each other and then carried that on with them mm-hmm. forward, even though they're not together.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I think they need to be together. Well, actually, so here's what I would say. I would say that
you're such a romantic.
I am romantic. That's my problem with this movie.
This is 16 candles all over again.
This is 16 candles all over. No, is it 16 candles or is it? I think what did it for me, was the fact that we get the pseudo alternate reality. We see that.
Yeah.
That both things were obviously there.
Yeah, but think about that.
Pushback.
Think about that alternate reality. Because what changes in that alternate reality from the reality that is real, from like what actually happens? The big difference there is that Seb sacrifices to be with Mia. Like that's the story of the alternate reality, right? He puts her before himself. Because at the end of that alternate reality, he's her husband, she's a famous actress, and he's sitting in the audience with her watching somebody else play the piano in the jazz club. Mm-hmm. You know? Like, she doesn't give anything up in the alternate reality. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm saying that the movie is about Seb, not about Mia.
Yeah, but then she's got tons of money, so the next scene is him just buying the club because he's like, she's got tons of money.
Suppose that could happen, but...
I think, keep going, Elijah.
No, I was just, I think the movie shows you that had they stayed together, one of them would have ended up in the exact same place, and the other one would have been in a very different place, regardless of whether they're together or not. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think that's what it shows you.
Which I think is what we were saying, and what you said really well in your review about how if your only framework is that, those are your only choices, then it is very conflicting. You feel what the film asks you to feel, just this like deep regret, but also, you know, confusion because what else could you have done? And she, you know, but I just think there's a broader framework, a different reality that that probably our culture cannot see as true happiness or joy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I also think it's strange that that La La Land doesn't include any other determiners of fate other than the will of Mia and Sebastian. Nothing happens by accident to them, you know? Mm-hmm. They make every decision for themselves. This is where a movie like The Umbrellas of Cherbourg adds a nice little kind of wise asterisk to what you see here. Because in The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which when you see it, I mean, it's so much of that is in La La Land, tonally. Like, there is an element of fate to The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, like an outside... just the chance of life, you know, that takes you away from the one that you love or brings you the one that you love, as the case may be, that I think adds just a greater reality to what happens. Which I think is important. I mean, there are people in my life who, you know, they were my friends for a time and they were very important to me for that time. But then life takes us in different directions, and that's okay, you know? Mm-hmm. Life takes us, God takes us, whatever you want to say, takes us in different directions. And it doesn't mean that we should have always held on to that thing, that friendship, that relationship forever, you know? Like, it's fitting to let go and let people go do what they need to do.
I'm down with that, too. Actually, just today, I was reminded of a New Year's party that we had, like, 7 years ago. We had like 40 some people crammed in our basement. And I'm looking around at this video from 7 years ago, and I'm seeing people who aren't even my friends on Facebook anymore. Like, life or whatever has just taken us in different directions. And to a certain degree, I'm like, oh, well, you know, that's a bummer. Mm-hmm. Or I would like to catch up with that person. But there's no one, in that room that if they walk into my jazz club 5 years later, I'm going to share this like longing, regretful stare with that, like, you know, that I didn't spend the rest of my life with them. And I guess that's the thing. I guess maybe I don't have that experience. I, I like to think that I found the person that I would have a long regretful stare with 5 years from now. And I said, hey, let's not do that.
But I think
she liked you to think that too. Yeah.
I think that something that I appreciate about the film though is that the emotions that it offers are pretty real and pretty visceral. I mean, that scene, I have felt those feelings before, perhaps not to that degree. I don't know, though. I mean, there's at least one person I can think of from that photo of that party that I have deep regret that we're not in relationship with anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's because of things that have happened that maybe they always had to happen that way. I don't know. I wish they hadn't happened that way. So I think that rang true to me. So maybe it was easier for me to just take that scene for kind of the real life scenario it was presenting, mm-hmm. and appreciate that part of it. Maybe that does happen. You make choices and other things are left behind because of that. And sometimes it's always a positive thing. It's always a growth thing, but I don't know. Often we grow because of pain and suffering and mm-hmm. loss and mistakes. So I can appreciate that scene for that aspect.
So let me take that one step further and kind of ask a concept question to you guys. When we talk about like missing out or like that person, like that regret, like it makes a lot of people ask, and especially in this movie, like the idea of there being one person for you. Like I said, going back to that discussion, there were questions of, you know, hey, I don't think there's just one person. You know, you love somebody for a time and then, you know, it moves on. But, you know, you always need to pursue your dreams, kind of things like that. And I'm just curious, because I have my own thoughts, none of which are like go to war kind of thoughts. But do you think there is such thing as a soulmate for a Christian?
Who are you asking?
Whoever answers
the general
first.
Audience. I think that you can't ask that question without it really being the broader question: does God have one perfect will for your life? I think it falls under that. And I would say, I have no idea.
And I would say, I don't know.
I have no idea.
I would say I do not think that God has one perfect will for your life. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm leaning in that direction.
I don't think that. I think that God is interested in being with us wherever we go in life and whatever we do. That God, that I am, is present with us and gives us there's a lot of freedom that we have to go and do whatever. Mm-hmm. That God will just be with us. And so I don't think for most people that there's this – that there's a script that they're supposed to follow. I don't think that. I just don't see God interacting that way with people in the Bible very often. God tends to be there with them, responding to their situation as they respond to it most of the time. There are moments where God steps in and is like, nope, you're doing this. but those are pretty rare.
I think the thing that complicates that's my general framework, but the thing that complicates it for me is, let's say Joseph, mm-hmm. and how all this stuff had to happen to him.
Which Joseph?
Joseph from the Bible.
Okay.
Is there more than one Joseph? Oh, you're right. Like Mary's Joseph. I'm sorry. Yes, yeah. I'm talking about Israel's son.
Okay. You mean the father of Christ? No, not that one.
So it seems like his life circumstances all were specifically happening to culminate in him saving his family from starvation.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I guess I feel like I've had kind of my own Joseph experience in my life, because I wanted to have biological kids. I had no idea that we couldn't. Through this whole long process, we came to adoption. We're head over heels for our son. We can't imagine having any other child, you know, but I would never would have come to that. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, mm-hmm. I guess I'm wondering, there's a part of me that wonders, was mm-hmm. it God's will for our life for us to be the parents of Jonathan, you know? Or is that just like, I mean, we did make that choice. We could have made the choice not to adopt.
So that's kind of,
I don't know.
That's why I'm in the in between, you know, because I do think that kind of like Elijah, you were saying, there's a lot of examples, or I don't really see, for the most part in the Bible, God interacting with people that way. It's more like people do what they're going to do, and God has the power to redeem.
But what about yeah. Joseph or Moses? You're going to go.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Save
like
your people.
I would say. I feel like most of the time it's okay. like people are like, I'm going to do this thing, and God's like.
I think God's just kind of like, I can work with that.
Yeah, and, okay. and so God's like, I can work with that. But
I can handle that.
But then I do see situations where you're talking about like Joseph, like was that just Joseph making decisions and God being like, I can work with that. Well, I can work with that. Mm-hmm. You're in jail now. I can work with that. You're in a pit. I can work with that. You know, or he's like, you know what? I'm kind of guiding things in place so you get on a specific path. And there's no place more clear to me. Well, not clear. That's probably the wrong way to put it. I would say there's no place that makes me think this than when I'm looking at lineages. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like, hey, you know, Christ will come from, you know, the lineage of David, you know, that like, that's a lot of, I can work with this. Mm-hmm. I can work with this. If it's not like, I mean, maybe this is the mystery of God too, you know, us thinking of time linearly.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Makes this very hard, but you know.
Is him knowing what's going to happen the same thing as him making it happen?
Yeah.
That question.
this is what many Facebook discussion groups are wrestling with now. But, and like I said, there are a lot of different opinions on it, but that's why I think that it's easy to push aside the idea of a soulmate. Because it does kind of seem like the world creeping its idea of romance and like this perfect person that like, I'm going to see, we're going to feel love for each other. We're always going to feel love for each other. Nothing but love. Cause we're soulmates. Mm-hmm. We're meant to be together. There will never be any questions that we'll be together. Mm-hmm. Like that is obviously, I think, a falsehood. Mm-hmm. Because I really, really enjoy being married, and I'm not just saying that because you're right there, but like it's something that I do enjoy. But I realize it's hard work, and I don't always feel perfectly loving and like whatever, but I saw this one quote that I think kind of answered it as best as I have seen it answered, and it says, when I was looking up, it's like theology of soulmates, thanks Google,
like you do.
It said, seen through the lens,
I do that at least once a week,
right? Like theology of soulmate.
Yeah,
you asked that specific question.
Yes, Google. Every week.
just double checking. Is there any way I can get out of this? It says, seen through the lens of theology of the body, a soulmate isn't a celebration of compatibility. It is a promise of transformation. It says, I choose you to help me fulfill God's plan for my life and to help you fulfill God's plan for your life in sickness and in health and richer and poorer, good times and bad, for as long as we both shall live. And what that means is that God doesn't predestine one perfect person for us to marry. But once we marry, that person becomes our one person. Mm-hmm. As far as like our vows and that transformation kind of happens. Mm-hmm. Which, and I ask all this because it's tough for me, again, to as a romantic, mm-hmm. As my wife will tell you, so romantic.
Their romance is so palpable. You want it to last forever. You want to believe yeah. something like that. That magic could exist
for eternity. So wanting to believe that, and believing it to a great degree, that's when I watch a movie like La La Land And I'm okay with sad endings. I'm okay with, like, we part our ways. But, like I said, it's the way that the film ended. Like, I just don't see people looking that longingly at each other. I don't imagine, like, people having, like, very visceral, like, imaginations of what could have been.
Yeah, people have those, though. That's real.
People are dumb.
I think it's worth saying, though, that... her dream about a different future is very Technicolor. It's very cartoonish.
Fake?
Yes, it's very fake. So you can't necessarily look at that and say, oh, that is the alternate reality. You know, when we dream, when we fantasize, everything is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't necessarily say that everything would have ended up perfectly. I mean, one of their biggest... I think really their only big fight happens because
it's a big fight.
It is a big fight because, you know, Seb isn't following his passion. Yeah. And if that reality means that Seb didn't follow his passion, I just don't see it being like a really star-eyed marriage. That's the thing that makes it a little bit more confusing to me,
mm-hmm.
the answer to that question, because the person they fall in love with, I wonder if that person could have existed if they weren't both pursuing their passions. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm not sure that a marriage would have been wise. I don't know.
Well, thank goodness they were just living together.
That's why you do that.
You just testing it out.
Yeah.
Oh.
Because as you see, there are no long-term repercussions.
That's right. Oh, man. Different.
But this may not fit here in the conversation, but a thought did come to me about comparing those two songs. Like I said, the one song that talks about, like, fame as the only worthy pursuit, mm-hmm. and then the other song that talks about love as the only worthy pursuit. I think saying that either of those temporal things is, like, the pinnacle of life is mm-hmm. dangerous. And I think that's why, as Christians, it's difficult for us to look at this film and pick a side. Because neither of those pursuits are healthy as your idol, as your you know.
Yeah, for me, it gets back to the thing that both those things obscure again, which is that, you know, love is a day-to-day choice mm-hmm. to put the other person ahead of yourself, you know? Mm-hmm. It's very much like the side of art that the movie doesn't show, which is the day-to-day grind of just doing the thing, mm-hmm. you know?
The unglamorous.
The unglamorous, yeah. Yeah, not the fame. The sitting down and typing away at a keyboard, you know? That's a lot of what marriage is, right? Mm-hmm. Sitting down, typing down a keyboard, working that thing out, you know.
Playing drums till your hands bleed.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You can't live in either of those moments if you want to survive.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I feel like we could technically go round and round on this because, like I said, I feel like the film delivers in a number of different areas because it is a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to almost give people their moment of catharsis for as confusing and as angry as the film made me. There have been very few films that came out in 2016 that made me feel anything but like meh.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
you kind of forgot immediately.
Yeah, I was like, well, that was a thing I watched, which is sad because I mean I love movies too much to waste time watching movies that are instantly forgettable.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if they're instantly forgettable and not really that enjoyable during the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope 2017 is different. And, you know, I harped on this during 2016, so a whole lot more. But, you know, La La Land, it was a lot of fun. And it was very engaging. And I think that, you know, the reason it was able to get such a visceral reaction from me is because it did draw me in. I was on the journey with him.
Mm-hmm.
I did love how the story was told. I know it didn't necessarily do anything that wasn't reminiscent of films that came before it, but if I could get musicals like this with music that I actually did like and do remember, and do want to hear again, then I wouldn't mind more of them being made. Yeah. So I really enjoy La La Land, and honestly,
I would say you should just watch more musicals.
Well, so that's what I did. We watched La La Land, and then I want to say it was only a day or two later that we sat down, and for the first time in my life, I watched Singing in the Rain.
And your whole life was better. Like, there's a before Singing in the Rain and an after Singing in the Rain moment, right?
It is 100% true.
Yeah.
I told Laura, I was like, I have no concept of, I couldn't explain to you what I thought that movie was about before I watched it, but that was not what I thought it would be.
Yeah.
Like, I thought it would be like watching Mary Poppins, except it was raining or something like that.
I feel like we need to watch Meet Me in St. Louis next. I love that
you
one.
You totally do. Yeah, you totally need to watch that. And if you at all like the melancholy of La La Land, you'll enjoy Meet Me in St. Louis.
Yeah. So, then it was, you know, it was Christmas time anyway, so we watched White Christmas.
To watch White Christmas.
And yeah. I realized I had never seen White Christmas.
Vera Ellen can dance, can't she? Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
So
just astounding. Like, that's a movie, White Christmas, man. You come there, you think you're watching it for Bing Crosby's crooning, but that's not why you come. Mm-hmm. It's like Danny Kaye mugging it up,
that's being right. hilarious,
and right. Vera Ellen dancing. That's the whole thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, but that's the thing. Like, I think because of La La Land, I said, you know what? Let me see what I've missed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things that I wanted to watch anyway, but... You know, the list of things that I wish I had time to watch is...
Just more prioritized.
Yeah. So I was like, well, you know what? I am now in the mood. This La La Land has got me to this place. So let's do this. And that's awesome.
Well, yeah. you told me once that you don't really like films. You didn't like musicals because you don't like how everything stops for a number and then the story continues. Did La La Land change that for you?
I think it depends on the music. And it depends on how it's done. There's actually, so the only part of Singing in the Rain that I did not like was when they do the keep dancing song or.
Yeah. The big number. Setting the stage number.
It goes on for so long and the entire story stops. Now, the funniest part about it is when he goes, hey, have you done this yet? He's like, no, but I've got some ideas, you know, like
that's it's roughly going to be like this.
Yeah. Like that's hilarious. Yeah. But like, it definitely takes like a detour and gives me like this multi-tiered, like multi-movement song that just takes me, like, I'm like, why is this? Like, at one point I said, did I miss why this is all happening? Mm-hmm. Like, is this actually happening? Or, you know, but everything else was, you know, just flowed right along. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are other things I find, like, my juvenile level of musicals that I've enjoyed up to this point, like Dr. Horrible's Sing-Along Blog is probably my favorite musical. Mm-hmm. I think it's brilliant. I think South Park the musical is brilliant. Like, I love these movies. I'm actually a little mad that Trey Parker did not win an Oscar for Blame Canada, because I don't remember what else came out that year, but it was definitely the best song that came out that year. So I tend to like comedies more too. Mm-hmm. But because usually they have more freedom within the narrative and the story that's being told. This has been True Confessions About Musicals starring Fizz. but yeah, so I say all that to kind of get to our final thoughts, because that's most of
Well, wait, before we final thought, can I just say something about musicals to you might help you with liking more musicals?
Could it be like, would it be like one of your final thoughts?
We can say that, sure. if you would like it to be that, this would be my final thought.
No.
I read this on Letterboxd. I don't know who this person was, but they were writing about Rick Altman and about the American film musical. And he says that it's wrong to watch them from a story perspective, that the story's not the point, which is like what you were saying, Laura, about how it's forgettable a lot of the times. You know, you don't really care. That instead you have to watch the numbers in a kind of complementary relationship to one another. Mm. So numbers in the beginning, towards the end, and so forth, and how they develop themes. It's like music, right? Like how it develops themes and how it develops motifs and emotional ideas. Mm-hmm. And so when you say that you don't like musicals, or when someone said they don't like musicals because the whole story stops for this musical number, you were never supposed to be watching the story anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, that was never the point. Yeah. Really, the problem is that the musical number stopped with the stupid story thing that has to happen too.
Double story.
You know, that's really helpful. I think I was kind of, when I was looking at the lyrics of the song, I was for some reason surprised that the lyrics were telling what was happening to everyone. That's exactly how it works.
Dude, that's probably my favorite line from any song almost ever in a musical type thing. When Community does the Christmas episode where everyone's singing.
Uh-huh.
Because Abed says they say what they mean and they sing what they say or something like that. Mm-hmm. He's talking about how like he never has to be socially awkward because he knows exactly what everyone feels at all times.
Yeah.
That is kind of perfect. Speaking of,
yeah, basically the songs are saying like, hey, this thing is going to happen. Don't be surprised.
That's right. Yeah.
So, like you said, so I'm just, trying to get us to the semi wrap up part. Cause we were about at that time. Yeah. And like I said, so my final thought is to, like I mentioned before, give that moment of catharsis. People who think I'm, too hard on this movie, for any criticisms that I have, it would not really break my heart if it was showered with awards. It's ironic to me, much like I feel like it's kind of interesting that Brie Larson won an Academy Award for Room when she really should have won an Academy Award for Short Term 12. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But because of the way the Academy works, you know, one film was never seen. And
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I really,
it's because you campaign for awards and no one that made Short Term 12 had the money to campaign for her to get an award for that. That's why.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm not going to begrudge Brie Larson for getting an award, because I think she deserves it. So in the same way I see La La Land and I'm like, okay, this can be the Oscar that Damien Chazelle should have gotten for Whiplash. And I'm fine with that. So whatever awards this movie gets, unless I see something crazy between now and, you know, the next month and a half, then, hey, I'm fine with that. It's a wonderful movie. It's a lot of fun. And while I might not want to watch the whole movie again anytime soon, I could probably listen to lots of the songs. So that makes me pretty happy.
Yeah.
And just because I don't think they're going to give Best Picture to Arrival, which it should, but that's fine.
Well, that's a whole different conversation, Mikey. Mm-hmm.
I know. Actually, and something else that you said, Elijah, made me think as well for kind of a final thought is, I know that I think we're all more or less on the same page about the Oscars, even though the Oscars are, to me, still fun, despite the silliness of it.
Fun. Yeah.
I'm really interested because I feel like there was a lot of original music this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested to see who's going to be nominated for best song,
mm-hmm.
Best original song.
City of Light, City of Stars.
Mm-hmm.
That's nominated for what? Golden Globe? It's nominated for something right now.
Probably
Golden Globe. That's the one they're pushing for awards.
Which I don't think is the best, but.
Yeah, they're pushing that one for awards because they're going to be pushing Emma Stone for Best Actress.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, her breakout moment, of course, is the audition song. So, yeah. But they're pushing City of Stars for the awards.
Man, it's such a natural process.
Hey, and actually, I think by the time...
No manipulation in
any
way.
No,
it has nothing to do with money at all.
We went to see Rogue One and there was literally airplanes like riding in the sky saying... La La Land, City of Stars, for your consideration over Hollywood. That literally happened.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
No pressure.
Yeah.
Man.
Well, that's the thing. They might end up pushing not even the best song from the thing, and it still might win because La La Land in and of itself is so popular and getting pushed so hard.
Yep.
But we show up for the popcorn and the dresses.
Show up for the popcorn and the dresses. Well, because, I mean, I think, you know, when you mention things like Sing Street and stuff like that, it's it is going to be interesting to see what kind of rises to the top, mm-hmm. the cream of the crop, you know?
Mm-hmm. If you will.
Not everyone's got another song in their head, which is all part of the plan. Okay, so, yeah, Elijah, final thoughts, man. Anything else that we didn't touch on that you want to touch on, or just moments or ideas that you just really found great that you wanted to mention?
In La La Land?
Yeah. Well, really with anything in life, you know? Like,
there was this one time I was hiking on the California coast.
It was beautiful.
And let me tell you, we broke out into song and dance. People say it never happens.
No, it happens in California.
But it does.
Yeah.
It does happen sometimes in La La Land. End scene. The final thoughts about La La Land. I really wish that this movie had remember pop-up videos? Remember that? I wish it was like pop-up video. And every time there was a reference to another movie musical, that it popped up on the screen.
Oh, that'd be fun.
That's what I wish, because then people could like write that down and go home and watch those musicals mm-hmm. that La La Land is so explicitly borrowing from, to use a gentle term.
I feel like this should be a project for the students at Fuller.
There we go.
If you make that into a YouTube video, I bet it would easily get, 3-4 million hits on YouTube?
I'm sure it probably would. Half alone. But yeah, I wish it did, because what I really wish that people would do that, like La La Land, is like what you did, is go watch, you know, really good musicals. Because mm-hmm. There are so many, and make sure and watch the musicals that were, you know, made for the for the screen, like film musicals, mm-hmm. not the things we get so many of nowadays that are like stage productions that are filmed, and it never quite works. Have you seen Seven Brothers?
Yes. I love that one. Yeah, Mikey has. Wait, no, I haven't.
I've only seen clips from it.
Oh, I thought we all watched it as a family.
No,
I grew up watching that one.
That was the film your family wanted to watch when I wanted to watch the playoff game. And so I came upstairs.
No conflict. There was no conflict. Decision.
So I came upstairs during halftime. That's the thing, Elijah. I came upstairs during halftime to go, oh, I'll check this movie out. And I had been relocated because everyone wanted to watch this movie and no one was watching this movie. It was on and everyone was just like, blah, blah, blah. Let's talk really loud so Mikey can't even hear the movie.
And you harbor no resentment, which is such an amazing...
And I'm not bitter about it to this day.
Okay, well, you need to forgive everybody. And you
start
need to
there.
Watch Seven Brothers.
I was just talking to a friend today about how amazing it is to me that like Vera or any of the brothers, basically, instead of the Wise Brothers, they're like professional. No, they're like dancer. Ballet dancers.
They're dancers, yeah.
Like their acting is completely believable. They didn't really need to just be actors. They, you know, they're the whole package.
My favorite is that one of the brothers is never allowed to speak.
Yes.
Have you ever noticed that?
Is it Frank?
It's Frank. Frank is never allowed to speak in the entire movie. Yeah,
he tries.
Yeah, he does. And Gideon can't sing. That's pretty hilarious too.
Yes,
but he can dance. He can all dance because that was Stanley Donen who choreographed that, and Gene Kelly like worked on it too. That's why it's such like muscular dancing. Mm. And that's what Gene Kelly was so good at, was this very athletic physical dancing compared to like Fred Astaire's kind of graceful. His feet never touch the ground kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they're both great. They're both really great. But I hope people watch a lot of really great old film musicals that are just wonderful, you know? Mm-hmm.
So was your point before we all kind of got off on that tangent that Seven Brides for Seven Brothers is actually one that was made for the screen, not for...
It's made for the screen. Gotcha. And so that the camera moves around in a really interesting way. The editing is essential. Yeah, it's great. And for the record, talking about Seven Brides and Seven Brothers is never a tangent. That's the main conversation.
That's what we were here for.
We finally got to it.
Yeah. All this was just a slow build.
Yeah. That's right.
It's the best.
Now we can leave.
Well, not before you give us your final moments, though, or your final moments, your final thoughts.
I think I pretty much said everything I wanted to say, but
I've done a lot of thinking. I quit my job teaching English about 5 years ago, 6 years ago.
It's been a while.
Which I loved and I was very good at.
She's very good at it. Trust me.
But I wanted to be a writer full time. I wanted to be an artist full time. And so ever since then, I've been doing the artist way by myself and with other people, trying to figure out what it means to be an artist, especially in a world that has really unhelpful and dangerous definitions for what that means. Mm-hmm. And I think that this film kind of plays into that a little bit because it is so pervasive, this idea that what it looks like for you to be successful as an artist, mm-hmm. or to even be worthy to be defined as an artist, is just really unhelpful. And I think like completely not based in reality. Like if you look around at the world and at artists who are doing art, it is not the thing that we think is reality is not reality. I mean, especially for like a writer, most writers are not like J.K. Rowling, but what do we try to be when we're writers? You know? Anyway. Yeah. So I would say other than The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron, the thing that has helped me most as an artist to have grace for myself and to be able to enjoy being an artist is this TED Talk that Elizabeth Gilbert gave a while ago called Your Elusive Creative Genius.
I know that one. That's great.
Yes, it is so good. I have to watch it at least every 6 months to remind myself just to kind of come back to a healthier place. So, I mean, I would even say, let's put that in the show notes and like let people watch that. Mm-hmm. That's been really helpful to me. And I also think that it would be really sad for people to listen to this podcast and think that we're like putting the movie down. Because I think mm-hmm. we talked really critically about it. But I mean, I agree with Mikey. I really enjoyed it. It was lush and beautiful and fun. And I felt all the emotions. I believed everything that was on the screen. Mm-hmm. I'm going to mm-hmm. listen to the music again. I thought that everyone, even though Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone are not primarily singers and dancers, I think they put a lot of work into that. I was amazed to find out that Ryan Gosling learned how to play the piano for this. Mm-hmm. And that none of the shots of his hands are CGI hands or like anyone else's hands. They're his hands. So I just think it's pretty evident that everybody on the film, like lighting, editing, writing, choreography, everybody worked really hard and worked well together and made something really fun and enjoyable. So please don't listen to this and think that we hated the movie.
Yeah.
Just because we're able to be critical.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I agree with that very much.
And I like, I'm connecting with what you're saying about the film kind of giving, yes, we all like the film, but like kind of like your critique of the film is being like giving like this false picture mm-hmm. of what kind of like being an artist looks like, because there are a couple times in the film that I think unexamined are unhealthy. And one is the mirror scene that we get when the unnamed famous person walks into the coffee mm-hmm. shop at the beginning. And like, that's what Mia wants to be.
Yeah.
Like she's not thinking like, oh, I just want to be in a movie. She's like, I want to be that person. And then we see that mirrored later when she is that person. And the person coming down the line wants to be her, mm-hmm. not wants to be an actress in anything.
Or really isn't inspired in any way.
Yes. Like I'm inspired to try to be famous. Mm-hmm. You know, we mentioned this. And the other is the idea of when Mia was discouraged and decided to go home. She's like, basically like, this is hard. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do it anymore. And it goes back to something that you mentioned earlier. I think that Julia Cameron, you're quoting Julia Cameron.
I was really badly paraphrasing her.
Really badly paraphrasing her. Yeah. You know, kind of saying that like, if it really was her passion, then she mm-hmm. couldn't help but do it.
Yeah.
Which again is why I think them together was so important in the first place. In kind of a semi once kind of light. I think once does it a little better, but maybe not the point of La La Land. So that, and you know, I think some people are also going to hear you and wonder how you quit teaching to be a full-time artist. And I mean, that's easy. Like, if your husband is a podcaster and makes tons of that podcasting money,
I know.
Then you can just basically do whatever you want.
I pretty much just write lounging in your buckets of money.
My podcasting money. Yeah. Oh, all that podcasting money.
I really use it as like the leaflets of my book. I just write on your money.
Oh, it's so absurd. Oh. I love talking to other podcasters about, you know, how this is just like a windfall, really. So, so if you've never podcasted before, I hope you have another job. So, anyway, I really appreciate you guys' final thoughts, and I've actually really enjoyed talking about this film. And I have no idea how long this will actually be, but I feel like it's about there. So, as usual, and I repeat this a lot, to the point where people can probably say it along with me, but great conversations happen because you have great guests, and I really believe that. And because of that, I want you, the listeners, to be able to follow the work and the ideas and thoughts and art of the guests. So, Elijah, where can people find the things that you do around the internet?
Well, I work and write for Real Spirituality at Fuller Seminary. So that's R-E-E-L, much like Real World Theology. RealSpirituality.com. You'll find most of the things that I write there, movie reviews and whatnot. I also, as my friends say, have a more honest is the wrong word. They say honest, but that's wrong. A more candid place where I write about movies, which is my own website, which is not for an institution where I need to have the mind of the institution in mind. That's ElijahDavidson.com, and you can find things there. So I'm also on Twitter at Elijah Davidson, although I'm trying to stave off the social media a little bit. So nice. It might be a while before I respond to you on social media outlets.
I hope that's only the case in not scheduling podcasts. So
yeah, we'll see.
we'll see. I'm kind of busy. How famous can I be from being on this podcast? So Laura, same question. How can people find what you're working on?
They can go on walks with me and listen to my,
listen to your poetry.
Poetry.
If you'd like to go on a walk with Laura, please don't be creepy. She is my wife.
Oh gosh. Well, I'm feeling very insecure about me as a writer and artist, but
tell me about how successful you are as an artist, babe.
I'm on Twitter at Laura_Fissel. I also write Doctor Who reviews, for Real World Theology. And I have a passion project that is a little bit stalled right now, but there are some great stories archived that you can check out. It's called familyrestoried.com, and it's just a collection of reflections from people who have experienced infertility or child loss on a variety of subjects.
Excellent. And if you would like to follow me, you can do that at Twitter, at Fizzification. As always, please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. Go to realworldtheology.com to get the show notes and all the links to our guests' great work. And there will also be a link in the show notes to our Facebook discussion group. And I cannot encourage you enough to just go there, and you will probably see all kinds of things, trailers, random conversations, best of, and discussions about the actual episodes themselves, because as usual, we don't have time to discuss every single angle of every single film because there are so many differing opinions. And when you watch a film, you bring a lot of yourself to that film. So there is almost, you know, as many listeners as opinions, or as many opinions as listeners, as it were, to almost every film. So please, 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 keep having conversations with your friends. Have conversations with us. Have conversations with Elijah. Have conversations with Laura. And in the meantime, for Real World Theology, I'm Fizz, reminding you that musicals are powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
I'm just scooting in my chair.
You need to stop scooting in your chair. It's very loud.
Sorry. That her imagination, like her imaginary, why can't I say this sentence?
I can't do that. My brain hurts.
Yay.
Yay.
Well, that was fun.
It was fun.